Well, okay. Hello, everybody. This is Singing Mainframes, or singing is a bit of an exaggeration, actually, so you should rather call it Beeping Mainframes, but that would make kind of a strange title in English, I think. So let's stick with Singing Mainframes. Before we get started, one second. All right, so a little bit about myself. I'm Utz. I'm a chiptune musician by the name of Irrlicht Project. And by chiptune, I'm especially interested in so-called one-bit music. So you know that most home computers from the 80s, they have these sound chips, and that's sort of where the name comes from. Well, there's some discussion about that, but I'm not going to go into that. But there were some machines that didn't have a sound chip, and I like to make music on those for some reason. We use some pretty advanced software tricks for that. And the interesting thing is that the way we do it with these machines actually traces back to the very beginnings of computer music. So, yeah, I'm also a tool maker. I make sound drivers for one-bit music, and I made a thing called Houston Tracker, which is a music editor for TIA graphing calculators. So some might have heard of that, or maybe not. And now I'm working on a project called Music Data Abstraction Language, which it's basically a project that aims to unify all the different trackers and chiptune editors that are out there in one standardized language. So you have one common input, and you can then write many backends to export to any kind of format you need. And when I'm not doing that kind of stuff, I'm looking into the history of computer music, especially the early days. And I've been doing that for around 5 years now. It all kind of started... Yeah, no, let's put this light, that's fine. So it all kind of started back in 2013 when I did a talk at the Shift Restore Escape Ringvorlesung at the Humboldt University about the history of chiptune music. And so this talk is kind of a bit of a follow-up on that. Basically, in the 5 years since then, I've discovered quite a lot of new things that we didn't know back then. And so this talk is mainly a presentation of new findings, stuff me and my friends have found over the past years. And so, yeah, this is original research. Most of it comes from digging through hours of oral history interviews, like Charles Babbage Institute at the University of Minnesota, for example. They've done some great work preserving these kind of things. Also, SciHist mailing list by Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. Been reading a lot of those. Also, Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California has a big fund of material. And also been reading a lot of BitSavers, obviously. And also there's another person who is working in a similar direction called Anders Carlsen. Some of you might know him as GoTo80. So he has this chip flip timeline of chip music project, and we collaborate on that. So the scope of this talk, well, broadly it's about use of mainframe computers as musical instruments. And I'm going to cover a time span pretty much from the very beginnings up to around 1965. So why 1965? That's actually a bit an arbitrary question. Yes. However, like in 1965, there's pretty much a transition from away from mainframes towards mini computers becoming the dominant form of computers, and the computer market explodes, and there's a new generation of users, and pretty much computer culture changes. So we're simply not talking about the dawn of the digital age anymore. But other than that, it's a bit arbitrary choice. So we could sit here all night, but got to stop at some point, right? A couple of topics I am not going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about algorithmic compositions. Like there was this push button Bertha algopop thing in 1956, and there was the pretty famous ILIAC suit by Liaron Hiller and Leonard Isaacson at the University of Illinois in 1957, and there's also later stuff by Xenakis and Stockhausen and stuff. And also, I'm not going to talk about commercial developments, so I'm not going to talk about Bell Labs and Max Matthews and that kind of stuff. Why? Because this stuff is fairly well documented. You can find the information is out there, and I want to focus on the more undocumented, the sort of underground computer culture, sort of computer folklore, if you will. And also, I'm not going to give much of a media scientific context. I'll give some nudges or some ideas about what you might take from this and what you might think about it, but I'm doing the historian part here, okay? I'm not trying to tell you what it's all about. So, topics we will talk about. Beeping mainframes, obviously. Sort of the whole semi-official, unofficial practices in early 1950s computing, by example of music, yeah. And, well, implicitly, this touches on the subject of intended use. I'm not going to talk much about that, but please keep it in mind. And also, something that is kind of important to me and I would like you to keep thinking about is the state of computer history awareness and preservation in general. Because I think merely the fact that I'm sitting here doing this for 5 years and... well, you'll see. Okay, so a general structure of this talk. I'm not going to do a chronological talk, even though that might be the obvious solution to things. We're going to have examples with sound also. And sorry to the people on the stream, we are not going to have the sound examples on the stream for reasons of copyright. But anyway, the examples are more going to be grouped by machine heritage, sort of, so that we can maybe trace some lineages or, you know, speculate about spread of knowledge. So anyway, we're going to start with a bit of an overview of computing in the 1950s in general. What were common practices? What was it like to be a computer user in the 50s? And then we're going to talk about some well-known examples of early computer music that we knew 5 years ago already. Now we're going to take a step back, and we're going to talk about how did we get there? Why did we get music on machines that are clearly not well suited for the purpose? And then we're going to dive into this whole five-year research and going to talk about a lot of lesser-known and forgotten examples. And then we're going to talk a little bit about implications. What does it all mean? Very briefly, and then hopefully we'll have time for some Q&A. All right, so computing in the 50s. Let's talk about machines. Basically, there's only a handful of computers in the whole world, maybe a few hundred by the end of the 50s. And as you all know, they're huge. They cost hundreds of thousands up to several millions of dollars or pound or what have you. And also because they're so expensive, they're kept running all the time and they do computations all the time. So computing time is a thing and is a valuable resource. Also, we have an operator-programmer distinction, which is kind of interesting. That means programmers normally don't get to touch the computer, right? The programmer writes his program and then he gives it to usually a typist who transforms the program into punch tape or punch cards, and then he gets back the punch cards and he checks them for errors. And if it's all fine, he gives them to the operator of the computer, and the operator will then run the program with his team of technicians. So you have this sort of interesting distinction of jobs that we don't really know nowadays anymore. Users of computers. Well, we have the military, of course, and the weapons industry. They're probably the biggest users in the early 50s. We have large governmental agency like US Census Bureau or CSIRO, which is the Commonwealth Scientific Industrial Research Organization. It's an Australian thing, very big. Also, then gradually we get more and more universities using the machines. And from kind of the mid 50s on, we get also large corporations who are getting in on the whole computing deal. So to sum it up, computing is serious business. I mean, no goofing around, especially not making music. And I think this is a general consensus now. When people look back, there's this sort of idea that, you know, it was this serious thing. And we know there were these few instances of music and this kind of thing happening on these machines, but we view them as kind of isolated, rare occurrences. And, well, this is something, this is a notion I want to challenge a bit with this talk. Also, generally, like in the era, people didn't know what computers were. Like the general population didn't know it. They actually felt threatened by this new technology. So we get this sort of promotion stunts on TV and radio to make the general population see, oh, these are nice and great things, and this is the bright future. And our first example is a typical example of the time in that sense. So let's talk about the Ferranti Mark I, based on the Manchester Mark I, and based in turn on the Manchester Baby, the small-scale experimental machine. It's developed at the Victoria University of Manchester, and the architecture was designed by Alan Turing. So it's the original Turing machine, basically. And the machine itself is designed by a team around Freddie Williams and Tom Kilburn. And the Ferranti one is the commercial version of that, built by Ferranti, UK electrics manufacturer. It's the first commercially available general purpose computer. There were at least 9 built, like 2 original ones, and then they kind of revised and upgraded the instruction set, and they built another 7. And the interesting thing about it is it has a built-in diagnostics speaker. They call it the Hooter. And you can activate it. There's a command in the instruction set specifically to activate the Hooter. So if you issue that command, the Hooter will make a small click. And Christopher Strachey, who's a mathematician and a friend of Turing, he noted that by repeating the hoot command in a loop, you could produce tones. And so he wrote a music program. And that music program played God Save the King and Baba Black Sheep and In the Mood. And eventually, on September 7th, 1951, a BBC recording team came round to the University of Manchester, and they recorded the music for their Children's Hour program. And there's actually, it was recorded on an acetate disc. There are 2 copies of it, and that's the oldest surviving recording of computer music. And so let's have an example of that. This is the Frank Cooper show. There's one of these discs in possession of the BBC. The other one is in possession of a guy named Frank Cooper. They're slightly different in sound quality. This is the Frank Cooper version, in any case, for all you, if you love that kind of detail. All right. Well, so that's how it went back in the day. The joke here being that the song is called In the Mood, so that's why she's saying, well, obviously the machine's not in the mood, right? Because, well, in any case, rumor has it that later it became a tradition for all Ferranti maintenance engineers that they would have to write a music program for each new type of machine Ferranti built. Whether that's true or not, I don't have any proof of that. We do know that there's music on the Ferranti Perseus and Pegasus, which are two mid-50s machine. And that's not surprising because the Pegasus is designed by Christopher Strachey, so that's how that goes. Also, apparently Christopher Strachey sent out copies of his music program on punch tape with the machine manual with each machine that was delivered. So, again, we don't have certain proof of that, but we know at least Shell Labs in Amsterdam, they received a copy when they got their Mark I installed. Okay. Second example. Also, this one is actually very well known. Anyway, the Cyrac, also called the CSIR-MK One. It's an Australian machine. It has a very different architecture from the Manchester machines, actually. I'll talk about that later. But the interesting thing is it actually has pretty much the same setup as far as that built-in speaker goes. There's no hood instruction, but the hooder is actually a data register of the machine. So to make it click, you write to that data register. And machine was installed in Syro Radiophysics Lab in Sydney in November 49, and supposedly it played music shortly after that. We don't have a specific date on that, but probably was like in early 1950. What we do know is there was a public performance of the machine August 7th to 9th, 1951, at the first conference of automatic computing machines at the University of Sydney, where the machine was playing Colonel Boogie and Bonnie Banks and other popular tunes of the time. And the music software for Cyrac was done by a certain Geoffrey W. Hill, or Jeff Hill, who was technical assistant of the team that built the Cyrac, and also by Trevor Percy, who was one of the two lead designers of the machine, actually. And like all machines from the time, like all these music programs out of that era, it has like a super limited range of notes. Like the range goes somewhere from A2 to D sharp in the fourth octave, but it only hits 11 notes in that range, so that was kind of the constraints that people were working with when making music. And then later, in 55, the machine was moved to the University of Melbourne, and there's a thing called the Music Program by a certain Thomas Cherry, and that actually already uses a macro language with actual note names and durations, and they also extended the scale a bit. So the reason we know all this is because there was a resurrection reconstruction project by Paul Dornbusch in the early 2000s, who did a lot of work digging up all these stories surrounding the machine, and he also wrote a book on it, which I recommend. And there's also several extensive sites on the web if you're interested in Cyrac. Well, I do have a short sound example for you again, if you would like. So, yeah, the thing is that these bloopers that are in this wonderful rendition of Handel were actually introduced by Geoffrey Hill. Like, that was his sort of humor, right? There's a version without them, but I thought I will bring this one. right. And another example that wasn't so well known when I did the talk 5 years ago, but now it's become kind of a thing that people know. So there's this machine called the Zuse Z22, which some of you might have heard. There's actually one here in the museum, but sadly it's not working as far as I know. It was developed in 1955 by a certain Lawrence Hanewinkel at Zuse. There's 55 of those built in total, and there are actually a few that are still working as well. The music history of the whole thing is not documented all that well. But we do know that it did play music in 1958, which is not bad, I think. And played Hänschenklein and Mitternachtsblues, which was like film music of the time. And music software for the thing was developed by some service technicians at the factory of Zuse in Neukirchen in Hünfeld. And I think the way this music program works is one of the most interesting pieces of software I've ever seen. So the setup with Zuse's Z22 is there's a built-in speaker in the console, but that speaker normally always clicks continuously, so it makes a continuous tone because each thing that gets sent through the bus, either a data or an instruction transfer, causes an automatic click. So the trick here is not to have it make it click in a certain loop, but rather to prevent it from clicking. And the way they did that is the machine uses drum memory, and the way they get it to not click is they pick a certain location on the drum memory, which is a certain distance from where they're currently on the drum memory, and that takes a certain amount of time. And by that they can, you know, time the pulses that will get sent to the speaker. I think it's very interesting. Anyway, this program actually made it into your official software library of Zuse, and it was distributed as program number 47. And then later it was also ported to the Z23 as program 1076. And I know that Friedrich Alexander University in Erlangen has a working Z23. And they also have USB for their machine, and they also have a MIDI converter, so yes, they can play music. If you're ever in Erlangen, go check it out. Anyway, I'm going to play an original recording from 1958, or somewhere around that. The whole thing with Zuse, we still don't have very good documentation. If anybody has anything, please let me know. Quality sound, isn't it? Funny thing, like I was mentioning that it was playing Hänschenklein. If you've seen the German version of 2001 Space Odyssey, that's the song that HAL 9000 plays at the end. Kind of funny side note. Well, but still, the question is, how did we get here? Was it by chance? Did computer music sort of invent itself? Because this circumstance that early computers have built-in diagnostic speakers, this was a common thing, it was not rare, this was regularly done. And if it wasn't done, what people would do, they would place a AM radio near somewhere near the main data bus, basically to do debugging by ear. They even had a term for it. They called it oralization of code execution. Basically, you could listen in on the code, and if something would sound strange, the operator would immediately know that, okay, something has happened. And the funny thing is, like, even that in itself sounds sort of almost musical. like, okay, I have one example of this. This is from Pascal. This is a Dutch machine. And here is the machine calculating prime numbers. Sounds like this. So on and so forth. Well, you get the idea, right? Well, okay, so was it that? Or was it maybe intentional? I mean, Ada Lovelace wrote in 1842, suppose, for instance, that the fundamental relations of pitched sounds and the science of harmony and of musical composition were susceptible to such expression and adaptations, talking about mathematics, the engine might compose elaborate and scientific pieces of music of any degree of complexity or extent. So obviously she's talking about algorithmic compositions, but still. Also, there's this whole thing, the supposed musical inclination of mathematicians. Also, one funny thing, like Alan Turing in his 1950 manual for the Manchester Mark I actually explicitly talks about producing some specific tonal frequencies on the machine's built-in Hooter. Like, that's a page from this manual. Oh, was it by chance? Was it intentional? I don't know. Good questions. I don't have any answers to that. So let's talk about a different question. And that question is, oops, I'm sorry about it. The question is, who was the first? Was it the British? Was it the Australians? Or was it the Americans? So there's this machine called the UNIVAC. UNIVAC 1, Universal Automatic Computer, designed by a certain J. Presper Eckert and John Maukley, who also built the ENIAC. Built by the Eckert-Maukley Corporation, which later became Remington Rand, which is now Unisys, I think. 64 of those built. First one was for the US Census Bureau, second one was for the Air Force. Doesn't have a speaker, but they figured out this AM radio thing fairly quickly. And there's actually a music routine by a certain Frances Betty Holberton, which uses this AM RFI trick. And supposedly she coded that up in the night before the inauguration event. So I'm still trying to figure out what is the inauguration event. What they do mean by this is the sort of delivery event when they invite the buyer, so the Census Bureau, respectively the Air Force, and demonstrate that the machine is working. There were two of those. One was on March 31st, 1951, and one was on June 14th, 51. So still don't know which is the one. In either case, it was before Sydney and Manchester. So we know that. And reportedly, it's even predated by another routine wrote by US Air Force Lieutenant Herb Finney, which I have not been able to find any information on the guy, whatever. But supposedly, Machine Blade, the Blue Tango, Eye of Texas, Air Force song, obviously. And that software is supposed to have been distributed with every UNIVAC one. So again, here, note the choice of words. I mean, we are talking about the beginning of computer music, and we pretty much know nothing for sure. I think that is kind of a shame. But anyway, UNIVAC later continued the tradition of having music on their big machines. So there's a music routine by a John Camina, who played Christmas music at the Methodist University in Dallas, Texas in 58. And there's a melody maker program by some unknown programmer at UNIVAC headquarters. We don't even know when that's from, but supposedly that was before Kamina did the thing. So was that the first? Next exhibit, the BINEC, or is it BINEC? I don't know. It's the first computer by Eckhard Morkley. It was built for Northrop Aircraft Company, which is like this huge, they manufacture military airplanes, actually. Machine actually never worked after it was developed by to Northrop, and Northrop and Eckhard Morkley keep blaming each other for that. But anyway, some guy named Louis D. Wilson had the genius idea to install a speaker on the machine. And there was also a certain Francis Holverton in the development team as a programmer. And she programmed the machine to play for He's a Jolly Good Fellow in 1949. And still don't know the exact date. We only the only evidence I have is a 1970 oral history interview with Francis Holverton and another source who is pointing to April 7th of 1949 during the completion of the verification tests of the machine, but I don't have enough evidence to say this with certainty. We only know 1949. So if you would like a round of applause for Betty Holverton, who was one of the original six ENIAC programmers, was the co-inventor of the COBOL language together with Grace Hopper. And she invented computer music, as we know it. And the interesting thing here is most publications out there can't even get her name right. Like, her real name is Frances Elizabeth Holverton. She was born Snyder when she was working on the ENIAC. She was still Frances Elizabeth Snyder. But anyway, the fact that we can't get her name even, right, says something about how we deal with digital heritage, I think. I mean, this would all be completely forgotten if there wasn't research work done by a certain Kathy Kleinman in 1968, and the story, 68. And the story goes like this. She saw a picture of the ENIAC computer with a bunch of women standing in front of the machine. And she started to ask questions like, who are these women? Who are these women? And she was told, well, these are probably models. And well, she wasn't satisfied with this answer, and she started digging. And then eventually she discovered that the original team of programmers at ENIAC was a team of six women. It would all be lost if not for her. Okay, so let's, now that we've cleared that up, let's move to another example. The Whirlwind Machines. Whirlwind machines were developed at MIT for the US Navy in 1948 to 51. Actually, Navy didn't want the machine once it was completed, so the Air Force got it. But the funny thing is, the machine's music capabilities were actually presented on CBS News during an interview with Jay Forrester, who is the head developer of the machine. And that was December 16th, 1951. And I happen to have a short excerpt from that show. That might take a second to set up. Well, so much for that. Serious programming at its best. So the tradition after Whirlwind 1, the tradition continued on the Whirlwind 2, also known as the IBM ANFSQ7, which is like the direct successor of the machine. It's one of the largest computers ever built. It was 250 tons, and it occupied a space of 2,000 square meters, excluding auxiliary equipment. And we have a quote from a guy called Doug Elliott, who writes, "There was a volume-controlled speaker on the main maintenance panel, extreme upper left. This was the only place sound was heard. We would program Christmas music for it." Okay, anybody spot what is the problem with this story? Okay, I will tell you. The problem with this story is that the IBM ANFSQ7 is the computer that runs the SAGE system, the semi-automatic ground environment, the missile, Cold War missile defense system. So serious computing as it best, as I was saying. From here, the tree of development of machine kind of branches off into two directions. So let's talk about IBM first. IBM. Yes, IBM brought a lot of joy to the music world. There's the IBM 701, which was IBM's first commercial machine based on the so-called IAS architecture, which we'll talk about in a second. And there's a guy working at Lawrence Radiation Laboratory in Livermore, California, called Norman Hardy and his colleague Ted Ross. And they write a music program, of course, what else? And they play Bach and Mozart on the machine, and supposedly Bach worked better than Mozart. And Norman Hardy writes, "The program was not more than a few cards, and we opted for one note per card to represent the music. Transcription to digital form thus consisted of choosing notes from piles of cards laid out like a keyboard, and other cards which controlled durations." Pretty convenient, if you ask me. What they did is they rewired one of the control lamps of the console to a speaker, and supposedly the whole thing was recorded on vinyl, but it seems that nobody actually has that vinyl, so that'd be interesting if that ever turns up. Anyway, then tradition continued on the IBM 704, which is like, despite the numbering, that's the next machine after the 701. Keith Reed Green, a researcher at Sarnoff Corporation, which is RCA, in Princeton, New Jersey, writes about the year 1959. "We had a 704 that could be programmed to play music. The program accepted input very similar to the play command in BASIC on the original IBM PC. The computer center manager was about to marry a key punch operator, so I coded up the wedding march, played it for him, and convinced him that he should exchange vows in front of the console. He went for it, but his bride-to-be vetoed the idea." Well, we also have four-voice Christmas music on the... That was a bit too quick. We also have four-voice Christmas music on the machine, done at IBM Labs in Moansic. And that is actually unrelated. Some of you might be familiar that the 704 is the machine that Max Matthews started to do his music series of programs. So, but as I was saying, I'm not going to talk about it. This is a development that happened independently of that. Also, there's music on the IBM NORC, which is like this super secret computer they built for the US Navy Bureau of Ordnance, which does like the weapons acquisition in the United States, which started running in December 54, and supposedly in 55, they moved it to a different place, and it used to play music for the yearly open day in the lab. And there was music on the IBM 1790 in 1961. Again, Norman Hardy doing the thing here. playing freeways music. There's also a famous vinyl called Music from Mathematicians. Some of you might have heard about that, which was done on the 1790 with specific DAC hardware, which contains the famous Bicycle for Two songs that is used in the original English 2001 Space Odyssey. Not going to talk about that. Again, you can find plenty of information and you can find rips of the whole vinyl online. There is music on the IBM 1620, also known as the IBM Cadet. Can't add, doesn't even try, because the machine, what they actually did, it doesn't have an accumulator. It uses like lookup tables for addition because they were trying to cut down on cost. So it was a inexpensive scientific computer introduced in 1959, and they leased it for $1,620 a month, which, yes, was considered inexpensive at the time. So there's this place, Los Angeles City Schools, and they offer free computer courses for high school students on Saturdays. And instead of learning Fortran, the kids put a radio on top of the machine and play music, of course. Reported by a certain Marty Biggers, who's now a retired senior biochemistry researcher at Stanford University. So apparently doing music instead of Fortran doesn't hurt that much. Also, there's a lot more on IBM. Like, there's this also these stories about printer music, like running on the 14.3 line printer. Like, there's this story from 1966 where a team of Tanzanian exchange students were invited to Sweden, and they played the Tanzanian national anthem. I don't have an example of that, but what I do have is another example of IBM 1403 printer music, just for curiosity. Might be a bit crude in sound. Hi, my friends. Moving on. So the other direction that split off from the whole whirlwind thing is the TX machines and consequently the PDP. So first computer after Whirlwind 2 is the TX0, also called the TXO, which is basically just a transistorized version of the Whirlwind 1, developed at MIT in 55-56. And there's a program called Music X by a certain Peter R. Samson from 1960, which was originally a single voice, but later he developed it. He actually managed to render three channels, and the editor is actually light pen controlled. So that's a nice twist, I think. And then later tradition continued on the TX2, where they actually installed high quality speakers for whatever reason they would do that, and it could play like stereo music and stuff. And also very much the whole music thing continued then on the PDP. Of course, we are leaving mainframe territory now, but I think that's interesting to mention because there's this whole history coming from the Whirlwind via the TXO machines. So the music activities of the PDP-1, they are pretty much kind of well documented. There's a lot of codes, there's bins, there's recordings. There's a software, again, by Peter Samson called the Harmony Compiler. Peter Samson, he's still alive. He's used to do typesetting, and he also designed synthesizers, and he was also working for NASA at some point. So anyway, this is the man right here playing Space Wars on the original PDP-1 with his colleague Dan Edwards. And they actually did, so by this time the sound setups start to get more advanced as well. So they have now four voice with flip-flops and filters. And there's a lot of classical pieces done, especially there's a lot of recordings by Bill Ackerman, Dan Smith. There have also been private vinyl pressings and all that kind of thing. I actually have another video example. Bear with me for a second. Pete Samson playing his program at the that's the Computer History Museum in California. All right. Well, let's talk about more examples, because you can always have more. So now let's talk about IAS machines. This is like, name comes from the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, and this is the original von Neumann machine. Like, this is his architecture that he had it development in starting in 1945. Even though actually von Neumann machine is a misnomer, because he didn't design the machine, he just helped with the team, which is kind of interesting. There's a large number of clones of these machines worldwide, including the famous Maniac that you might have heard of. There's the ILIAC, which had this algorithmic composition stuff that I mentioned at the beginning. There's some debate whether the CYREC, this Australian machine, was actually an IAS design or not. Anyway, what we do know, it had music on the JohnnyAC. In 1956, there's a music assembler by Morton Bernstein, which is part of the official JohnnyAC software library. There is music on the Cyclone, which is pretty much a little bit pimped up JohnnyAC built at Iowa State College, completed in 59. And there was a guy called LaFar Stewart who programmed the machine to play music in 61. And he was actually on NBC radio program Monitor in 1962. However, I don't have a recording of that. Also, there's an IAS machine called SARA, which is Saab's Räkneautomat in Sweden. And that played music in 1958. And there was a software called Music by some Sven Ingvall, which was part of the morning ritual. Like, when they would boot up the machine, they would play, they would use this music software and play a song for the whole hall to hear. If it played false, everybody knew the machine had a defect and could rush to solve the problem. Probably music even existed on the Besk, which is like the predecessor of the Zara. But we don't know about that. I need more information on that. Also, tradition continued later at Saab with the data Saab D1 and D21. You can look that up if you like. I'm wondering about others. I mean, there was a lot of these IAS machines. There was Dask in Denmark, and there was Weizak in Israel. I would love to hear something about these machines, but as of now, I don't have any substantial data. And well, let's talk about the ACE and English Electric machines. Also, pretty early design by Turing, completed in May 50. And yeah, what do you know? They played Bach, and probably already in 1951. And later, there's a guy called David Clayton who wrote some very strange music routine. A certain guy called Donald Davis, who you might know as the inventor of packet switching. He wrote, I can't remember the details, but it was something like this. A long delay line with 32 instructions was the source of the program, and it was initially empty. The program would be in a loop and therefore give a note from the speaker. By fixing the operation to add in a suitable bit in the instruction delay line, the counter would spill over into the timing fields and periodically enter a new kind of loop. Using the right switch settings made the loop size stay constant for a while, a note, then abruptly changed size. Loops were always a multiple of 32 microseconds long, so notes had frequencies which were submultiples of 31.25 kilohertz. The music was based on a very strange scale, which was nothing like equal tempered or harmonic, but was quite pleasant. Initially, the playing rate was rather slow, as though it was simply familiarizing the listener with its unorthodox scale. Higher up the scale, when the notes are a bit high even for young ears, the spilling over process gets more complex. It's next to impossible to work out what is going on the delay line with the instructions changing all the time. The next bars of music are a little faster and the scale of note appears generally rising but not now varied in sequence like an arpeggio. This repeats with even faster and more complex patterns until it becomes too fast and complex to follow. Well, even the explanation is too fast and complex for me to follow, to be honest, and I do understand a thing or two about this kind of music synthesis. But interesting to know that they were not just, you know, doing the standard cover of Mozart and Bach and whatever, but also experimenting, you know, with more unusual things. Whole tradition then continued on the Deuce, which is the next machine, and eventually there's a commercial version of the machine called the Bendix G15, which was made by a company in Los Angeles in California. They completed it in 1956, and they had a user program number 41 in their official catalog, which turns out to be a music program. And I have actually this very interesting video example here, if I can find it, from the Christmas season of 1958. There's a mathematician called Janet Norman, and she will demonstrate the music of the machine live on some CBS game show. It was called I've Got a Secret. I don't know, Americans might know it, I don't know. Yep.
Power plant design.
Well, by all these examples, I hope I have convinced you by now that actually this whole music business was not that uncommon in the early days of computing. But if you're not convinced that it was kind of a common practice, oh, there's more. There was music on Armac, which is this Dutch machine at the Mathematisch Centrum in Amsterdam, which used to play the national anthem when a member of the royal family would visit in the 1950s. There's some music program on Ferranti Perseus by a certain Christian P. Burton, which actually uses tape loading clicks, like the clicks that the tape loader does, to do percussion. And that's from 1957. There's music in 1960 on the CDC 1604. That's like one of the first computers designed by a certain Seymour Cray that you might have heard about. And that's delivered to the US Navy already with a 3-bit DAC music program. 3-bit DAC on a machine for the Navy. What for? Actually, there's a lot of stories about this kind of stuff happening in the military. Like I have some very interesting one from later, actually, from Vietnam. So they were doing it while being in Nam. Also, there's this this vinyl pictured here. This is called Rekengeluiden van Pascal, done by a certain Wim Nijenhuis. And this actually has, on the front side, it has just noises from the machine. Actually, the prime number calculation that I was playing for you earlier, that's from this vinyl. And on the back side, it also has some normal music, and it also has like stochastic compositions, so algorithmic stuff. But my favorite example of all of them, the Telefunken TR-4, is a German-Dutch machine, completed in 1962, cost like 5 million German marks. And there was a music program by a certain Mr. Smits and a certain Mr. Fisser at the Rijksuniversiteit in Groningen. But also the Finanzverwaltung Nordrhein-Westfalen had one of these machines, so that's the Office of Finance of the State of Nordrhein-Westphalia. And what do you know, they put a radio on top and they played music. And I don't know why they did that, but the head of the superior department of that Finanzverwaltung, he said, but they also had a light show with like blinking lights and stuff, and they could scroll text. And he said that that helped him secure several millions in funds from the Landtag, from the parliament. So if you ever wonder where your tax money is going, it's going into playing music on mainframes. All right. So this pretty much concludes my talk. So I think what has become clear, I hope, or what I was trying to get across, that computing culture back in the day wasn't maybe this super serious thing that we tend to picture now when we think about it. And also another point that I want to stress again, like this is all, there's so much vagueness and uncertainty surrounding this subject. So I think we really need to do more work to preserve our computer history. Actually from the time of the mainframes, we're still kind of okay. We have quite a bit of documentation, but for example, when it comes to mini computers, so we know what happened on the PDP, but there were like hundreds of other mini computers, and we know almost nothing about these machines, which is a shame, I think. So we should do more to preserve that. Also, I would be very interested to hear what was going on in the Eastern Bloc. I haven't found any examples of that. That would be very interesting. Also, interesting enough, I don't know anything about France. If anybody knows anything, Please, if you find anything, also from later times, not just from the mainframe area, if you find any material surrounding this subject, please do send me a mail and let me know. I'm very curious. All right. So, well, if you guys want to read some more, I didn't make like a big bibliography or something. These are the two, like this. The above one is the chip flip timeline maintained by Anders Carlsen. And the lower one is like a little private list I'm maintaining in some small little forum. But if you want to get to the source of these kind of things, there's a lot of links there with the materials that I'm sourcing this information from. So yeah, that's pretty much concludes my talk. And if you have any more questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. Anybody? Yes?
Is there still anyone known composing music for these machines these days?
Not that I'm aware of. I actually tried to do some work myself with the folks in Erlangen, but it sort of didn't work out, so I have to try again. And I know there's a guy in Britain who did something on the EDSEC, which was originally not a thing as far as I know, because the machine's too slow to make music, but he made something where he used it as a sort of drum machine. But generally, no, it doesn't seem to be a big thing. Also because like a lot of these machines simply don't exist anymore. They only exist in parts. Right, there's simply not that many that still work.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hello. Following that, are there emulators for some of these machines? Or are they just lost when the last of them dies?
There are simulators for some of them. But there's nothing that emulates the sound, actually. Not at least not as far as I'm aware.
Because that's noise on the physical bus. I suppose because the sound is, in most cases, has been noise on the physical bus of the machine, which wouldn't be emulated normally.
Yeah, that would be one case. Also, as I was saying, there's quite a few machines who actually have speakers built in. But seems pretty bleak as far as actual emulation goes. It's just simulation, so you can run programs from back in the day and it will give you like a computational result that is correct, but it won't run like cycle exact or anything.
I was a bit unclear about this point. The machines where speakers were built in, wasn't this also just bus monitors, or was there some kind of directed output to these speakers?
Well, we had like in case of the Mark I or in case of the Cyrec, you actually had to specifically address them and talk to them and make them do something. But there's all kinds of different designs. There's also designs like the Zuse, for example, which just make noise all the time. There's designs where people connect them to specific bits of the accumulator, for example, and that gives you some sort of more controlled result, as you can imagine. But then again, there's also a lot of designs where people just put something near the bus and listen in. So yeah, there's actually a huge variety of setups that exists. All right, seems you folks are all satisfied with that. So thanks again for listening.